Welcome to episode 29 of Island CT Podcast,
a podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick, and together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast. Okay, I goofed up the start. I think we'll use the second start.
Okay.
So, I always start the ending, and so I got confused. Anyway.
That's okay.
Administrative stuff. We're really late.
Yes, we're late.
Well, not really. We're, what?
I'm really late on getting your blog up. But
just
I will
the one,
get those.
Just the one. Mm-hmm. But the podcast is being recorded the 15th of February.
16th.
16th, that's right.
Yep.
So we're like 6 days late or so.
Right.
Four days late, maybe. Mm-hmm. Something like that in recording. Anyway, we've been busy, so we have really good stuff in the planning.
We do.
Which puts stuff off, and so, you know, the podcast should never get in the way of the stuff that we're going to then talk about, right?
Right.
It's always, it's about...
Did you want to start with your blog?
Okay, sure.
Since it goes right into what we've been busy with.
Yeah. Although, you know what? No. We started doing things...
the articles first?
We started doing things by topic. Mm-hmm. And so actually, we should just mention the blogs when they fit in with the topic. Doesn't that make more sense?
Yeah, that sounds great.
So mine will actually be showing up way at the end.
Okay.
And yours too. Mm-hmm. So I was generally... we started to do more of the biological type of stuff first and then moving down the list from that. Are there ones you're interested in talking about?
Well, I was...
Or do you want me to start?
I was looking at your order.
Yeah.
And I like the order that you had down. So how about we start with Loki
Archaeota? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we mentioned the article first again. Mm-hmm. So this is an article about mitochondria.
Right.
And where they came from.
It's called The Pathogens to Powerhouse. And it's an article that was just published in Science on the 12th of February of this year, 2016.
I can't find it anymore.
And a few of the highlights of the article that I really liked... And mine was a perspective that I'm reading. You're reading the actual article.
No. I was reading. I just can't find it anymore.
Okay. It's a perspective from Science. And what I really like is that the authors went through step by step of what caused the relationship the development of the mitochondria and eukaryotic cells. So I found it interesting, and they went through it in a step process. And for me, it was really helpful because I was like, oh yeah, that's right. And what made the archaeobacteria more open to having this relationship, this endosymbiont relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's out of the February 12th issue. Mm-hmm. And it's not really, there's no associated report or anything. It's just a...
It's just a well-written
just a news
article,
type of article
that does the overview of the evolution of this relationship.
Yeah.
And I just really appreciated it. And
so, the part that I liked in particular about it is, I mean, there's not a lot about Loki Archaeota, which we thought was really cool, but, and it's not new information about it. It's rather the significance of that finding is starting to creep into the rest of the world of evolution, very early evolution, what makes eukaryotes.
Right.
And the whole section about the rickettsiae, or rickettsials. So they're pathogenic organisms that are intracellular. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought of them as, and they mention it here as being very small genomes. And it's fascinating, all of these parasitic organisms that end up with very small genomes because of their dependence on the host. But what was neat was how there's actually two totally different branches, right? Mm-hmm. And there's the ones we think about, which I guess infect mostly arthropods.
Right.
And they have really tiny genomes.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this whole other branch that infect protists.
Right.
And they have really large genomes. It's the exact mm-hmm. opposite. And they appear to be more closely related to the earlier forms of the rickettsiae.
Right.
And that puts them closer closer to Lokiarchaeota.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore the origins the eukaryotic cell. I didn't totally understand the part about there's never been found a kind of midpoint between, you know, eukaryotes that don't have a mitochondrion.
Right.
And they're like, because there's no such thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't totally understand, but I think what they meant was that they talk about this arms race, right?
Mm-hmm.
Between you have these archaea that are becoming really well adapted. I mean, what's the point of Lokiarchaeota? It's endocytosis. And getting energy from your environment. So that makes sense in a situation where your environment is very mm-hmm. nutrient rich. And, you know, they were found in the mud by some undersea volcanoes where you get all this stuff going into the water and all these communities. So that makes all sense. Okay. And there, I think what they're saying is, so you have this machinery that develops, and it's not quite eukaryotes yet, but it'll make it possible to engulf bacteria more easily. And then it does that, and then you've got an arms race
mm-hmm.
that develops.
Right.
And so you have this whole evolutionary history
mm-hmm.
of an arms race between stuff that keeps getting engulfed and it's trying to stay alive mm-hmm. and stuff that is engulfing it that's trying to kill it.
Because right.
it's, right? And the two start to match each other. And
right. You start right? to have this unique relationship
exactly.
because of that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think what they said, like, there's no such thing.
Right.
Simply that it slowly evolved. And mm-hmm. then eukaryotes came after this evolution had gone pretty far. And so there's no eukaryote that then engulfs a bacterium, mm-hmm. gets the mitochondrion, you know, and then
yeah.
picks off.
And I like the way they put it. Living cyanobacteria neither possess a genetic toolkit to evade the host's defenses, nor do they encode effector protons or proteins to interact with the host cellular machinery.
Oh.
So I thought it was this neat way of summarizing what we were just talking about. Anyway, I find it fascinating. And just to think of the
whole—it's very complicated.
Yeah, I don't understand it totally, but just to start to see the evolutionary process, I find it just fantastic.
I totally missed the whole section on cyanobacteria. So they come pretty late. Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. of course. Yeah. So.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, it's because of, you know, that being able to evade the host's defenses, but not having anything to fight back, made them develop this endosymbiotic relationship. And I love it. I just thought, wow, it's just very cool.
Archaea, including TAC, T-A-C-K. Do you know what that is? I missed that totally. They have a.
I haven't looked at
they
it.
Have a good, they have a
I'd
good.
I'd have to go back and look at it.
They have a good chart, evolutionary mm-hmm. tree thing on page 660.
Yep. I have it.
Which shows a lot of these relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Okay. Very interesting article. I look forward to hearing more about that topic.
I want to hear that they've isolated Loki Arachiota, right?
Yeah, I do.
That's
too.
What I want to see.
I know.
And what would be really cool is if they can culture it.
Yes.
So, yeah. But I haven't seen
that. Because just to be able to study something like that would be fantastic.
Close this one down?
Yep. And I thought maybe we could transition over to Greenland and the ice sheet. And this is something that you really dug into.
You didn't like my other biological.
Oh, I didn't see it. Oh, no, I didn't. I missed it.
Bacterial symbiosis and methane oxidation.
Oh, tell me about it. Sorry, I missed it.
It's not the same. It's close. So this is, again, same journal.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a report.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a perspective that goes along with it. I'll keep it short. Okay. I haven't looked at the perspective very much. Like, you can see just the first column only underlined. Pretty complicated. I would have loved to dig into this if my chemistry was a little bit better. But basically, there's these marine sediments that are anoxic. And there's archaea there that oxidize methane.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they live. And the tricky part here is that, first of all, it's going to be pretty slow growing, I think, because the oxidation of methane to CO2 is close to thermodynamic equilibrium there.
Mm-hmm.
They have an energy value, but a voltage difference. So that must be a half cell, I'm not sure. But I don't know what it means, so I'll skip it. I didn't have a chance to look into it. But of course, you're going to need to get, if you're going to oxidize methane, you need something to supply the oxygens. Or you need something that's going to accept the electrons. And they list sulfates, nitrates, and then some metal oxides as possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, where do you get them? And it turns out that in the same goo, you have these bacteria. And the bacteria, they reduce sulfate.
Okay.
So I think that step is actually very difficult to do.
Right.
So I think the reduction of sulfate then gives the electrons for the reduction, or the electrons needed for the reduction of the sulfate is provided by the oxidation of methane.
Neat.
And there was always, I'm not going to go any more into this, just to say that the finding here, the way I understand it, is that it was not really sure how this transfer happens. And it's a new term. They call it syntrophy.
Syntrophy. What is that?
So, I don't know.
Okay.
I think it's a mechanism, a little bit like symbiosis.
Oh, okay.
But it's, they're both living in the same area. They need each other.
Right.
But the transfer of the nutrients they need is done extracellular. They're not, like nitrogen fixing nodules in the plants, in the roots of like elder trees and stuff. That's symbiosis.
Right.
They benefit each other. Here they benefit each other, but they're totally separate. And the way they know this is they took, I think it was the archaea, and they cultured them in the lab and supplied the oxidizing.
So it's mutualism.
So what's mutualism?
Mutualism is a relationship in which both benefit.
Both benefit.
Right.
But they're not necessarily symbiotic.
Right.
Right. So that's what it would be, I guess. Well, but they call it syntrophy. I'm not sure.
Oh, maybe I have that wrong. Yep.
Anyway, I think it's the archaea they cultured. Known as syntrophy. During this cooperative, this is from the perspective, during this cooperative interspecies interaction known as syntrophy, well, that doesn't help.
Yep.
The excess reducing equivalents released by one species feed the second one.
So it's like a trophic level.
Well, they're on the same trophic level.
Are they? Okay.
Yeah, it's horizontal.
Okay. I'm trying to think of differences. That's why I'm like, why did they use that term?
The only two species.
Synergetic.
The two species only gain energy when they work together.
Right.
Because the reducing equivalents you've got to get rid of them.
Trophic goes with energy and symbiotic together, or syntrophy together, creating energy.
Oh, maybe they cultured both.
I don't know.
Anyway, the point is they cultured at least one, maybe both, and showed that if you provide extracellularly the right materials, either reducing equivalent or oxidizing equivalents, then they grow by themselves. So it's got to be through an extracellular transfer. Or an extracellular transfer is enough. Anyway, so that's all. The chemistry in there is very cool.
Neat.
And nice pictures.
Yeah, they are. They're very cool.
Of little... Anyway, so...
Okay.
Close this one down. Now, do you not have any other biological... You were talking about other stuff. Did you look at the Zika stuff at all?
I read it, but I didn't see something...
Something new.
Different and new.
Yeah.
So I just left it. It's kind of in a holding pattern where I'm seeing similar information repeated.
What about your biology comes late to...
Oh, so that one I wasn't as impressed with, so I was leaving.
Skip it? Okay.
Yeah.
I see.
So gotcha. I was going to actually the ice sheet. Because I was going with your list. And before we start, I think every time we've talked about the ice sheet, we've had this long pause where we're like, when was the last ice age? And at the very bottom of this article, it says the termination of the last ice age was 11,700 years. But every podcast, I think there's the pause. Huh, when was the last one? So we'll start with that. And this article...
Which defines the Holocene.
Yep, the Holocene. Exactly.
So it's interesting. 11,000 years ago. So 7,000 BC, that's 9,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you figure the starting of like the rice farming and stuff like that. So 9,000 years ago, 9, 10, 11, 2,000 years before that. You know, that was the end of the last ice age, and, you know, that's not even as long as how long ancient Egypt lasted as a...
Mm-hmm.
It lasted more than 2,000 years, yep. I think it lasted around 3,000 years. So,
Yeah. So, before we go too far, I should introduce the article. We're talking about the Ice Sheet in Peril article.
Well, is that...
It
is. That's a perspective, right?
Yeah, it's a perspective from science, and it's February 5th, 2016.
Is there a report, or...?
It is a perspective. Minus.
Trying to see. McGregor et al.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, okay, there's a report that goes along with it. From February 5th. Anyway, I found the perspective actually quite handy. I really like the perspective.
I did like it. It was nicely organized so I could get information quickly and I seemed to grasp what was going on.
Okay.
Okay.
You go.
So, actually, this was your choice. So
I should go?
Yeah, you should go.
Okay. The whole point here is that it's difficult to figure out what's happening in Greenland. And we have radar data that looks over all of Greenland. And so that gives us an average view.
And then they use that radar data with ice core data to double up
the
information.
Is that right? Two ice cores. So I'm going to bring it up. If you go, the perspective doesn't have any maps. Is that right?
No, it does not.
Okay. So if you go to the very first set of maps, figure one.
So what article are you on?
This is the report.
Okay, the report. Yep. I just wanted to clarify.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. Let me put it on the hand. Figure one, the very first set of maps, the one all the way on the left is the depth of what they call the 9Ka isochrone, which is a layer. So the neat thing about this ground, this penetrating radar, is it shows layers over large areas. And the perspective has a really nice figure, no number to it, that shows in one of the places these layers. And you can see surfaces or lines that you can track over very long distances. And they show 11,700 years ago, start of the Holocene. Mm-hmm. And above that, you have that 9,000 years ago, that's that isochrone. Mm-hmm. So same time, isochrone.
Right.
And they're just different layers of deposition. It's a little bit like tree rings when you think about it.
Yeah. Actually, on little clips that I've used with the class when we do ice cores, that's the way a lot of researchers refer to it, kind of like tree rings, depending on the type of year and how cold it was and how much accumulation you have. It builds at a different rate.
Yeah. So they didn't do any measurements, or they didn't do any analysis for the stuff below that 9,000 year isochrone.
Mm-hmm.
The reason in the original research was that below that, it gets hard to tell. There's a lot more variability in the ice, and it gets hard to tell what happens to it. And so they're going to do some analysis later about that. But it's really neat. They date all the stuff below that, and you have 14,700 years ago. There's a particular start of a time period. The last glacial maximum, 20,000 years ago, marked as an echo-free zone. And if you look at it, you see the lines are practically impossible to see.
Right.
And it goes all the way, their deepest layer, but it goes even further. Their deepest layer is 52,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, that's kind of to the limit of, well, no, we were humans for a lot longer than that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the map that on figure one in the report, it has in color the depth of that isochrone. And you'll see a pink line around the edge. And if I remember correctly, oh no, that's a modeling line. It doesn't matter. So that's important for the article, but not for us. But you notice that there's this white all around the colored area that shows the isochrone. And I think around this area is where that isochrone's not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So you still have ice.
Right.
But that's all gone down into the sea, stuff 9,000 years ago. So that's the end of the isochrone.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, that is.
And there's two spots marked. In the northwestern edge, there's one marked CC. In the very southern edge, there's one marked DYE-3. Those are the only two ice cores they're using.
Oh, you're kidding.
No. This
I assume there were several.
No, this, well, there are two. And they gave them Camp Century and DYE-3 ice core sites. Anyway, so that's to give a feeling about the research. So what did they find? Let me try to remember. Say stuff. I forgot. okay. Okay, let me think. I think what they were saying was that when they put together all of this, they found that a lot of the analyses in the past, well, they didn't find, but a lot of the analyses, you look at what changes you see in the last decade.
Right.
And you think, okay, well, that's what's happening now. And then you go further back in time and you see at the different layers of ice, what was happening? You're like, well, that's So when you have this type of climate, you get this type of effect. But what they found was it looks like, and you have to understand their analysis to understand exactly why this is, but it looks like major changes happening now are because of the sudden change in conditions at the end of the last ice age. So that's
right. Over the last 9,000 years.
After that. And so these are very... The point is that you have effects that that act over different time scales.
Right.
And the time scales of the effects of the changes in the world, like climate, mm-hmm. and the changes that happen in the way the ice sheets move, so the dynamics, mm-hmm. are different.
Right.
Right. You're going to have something that happens on the time scales of centuries, but the effect happens on the time scale of millennia. But you have other effects that happen on this scale of a decade, but you know, you might have an effect that's on a yearly effect. So in other words, it's
right.
You have, you know, it responds faster than the change. So it's always up to date, so to speak. Anyway, and they found that there's some areas where it's Greenland's actually getting thicker.
Right.
And it looks like it has to do with the very oldest ice from the last ice age is softer.
Right, the composition of the ice sheets themselves.
Yeah. It's softer, mm-hmm. and it contains more rocky material,
mm-hmm.
which partially and dust and whatnot, so that makes it softer, and it's being replaced by the harder ice that we have nowadays,
mm-hmm.
or that's formed by the climate we have nowadays. And so as the old ice is starting to be melted away, which happened pretty fast, now it's starting to slow down,
mm-hmm.
because we're getting rid of the ice from so long ago.
That's right.
The stuff that's melting. So it makes the glacier slightly more resilient than people thought. And of course, there's still a lot of questions.
Right. And I think when it comes to the composition of the ice veracity, it's like something that they're still working on.
Right, because they went totally linear, right? There's
right.
no effect of direction mm-hmm. Included in the models and the analysis, and there's no effect of what's happening upstream or downstream.
Right.
So if you have suddenly... some major effect upstream that's not included in their model.
Mm-hmm.
And that could explain why some of the stuff's happening. Anyway, so.
And, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot more that needs to go to be understood. And as they're able to add more parts to the story, it will become, I think, a much more complicated process.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay.
Cold for Greenland?
Yeah.
Was there another one?
You did have one other one where the sea level rise slowed by hydrology. And I did get to that one.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You're going to have to take the lead on that one.
Oh, where did he go? Must have been from February 5th. I don't see where it is.
Okay.
But I can do that from memory.
Okay.
So it was published in Science.
Mm-hmm.
And basically they're looking at you know, we've had for a long time now the radars that have been making very careful measurements. These are NASA
mm-hmm.
Satellites. They're making very careful... Did I say radar?
Yeah.
No, satellites.
Satellites.
They're making very careful measurements of the gravity as they go around the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a big continent. You have more gravity.
Right.
And we've been able to tell a lot with that. And they've been up there for a long time. And as the record gets longer and we get more stuff that we can match it up with locally on Earth, measurements we've taken, then we find, okay, now we can predict exactly what's happening, you know, due to processes inside the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like after you've done a bunch of passes over a landmass, if you see the mass going up, that's pretty much just water. Now you have to tease out many effects of changes in the rotation of the Earth and mm-hmm. other things like that. But basically they can do that now. And so they looked at, I don't remember the time period, but we're looking at decade, maybe, I'm not sure. They looked at changes in the water content in the Earth. And they think that the sea level rise, so first of all of those models of how much sea level rise we're going to have due to global warming and all sorts of other effects like human water use and whatnot, don't include groundwater because it's been so difficult to figure out how much is there.
Right.
And with this now, they're able to tell, and it looks like groundwater is a humongous amount of the water around the Earth. And you, as humans, our activities tend to remove that, and there's lots of aquifers
right.
that are going dry. But climate change has the opposite effect. But it's not refilling aquifers, so that's
right.
an issue. It's other places. It's like all mm-hmm. over the place. And that groundwater seems to be going up because of increased cycling and therefore increased precipitation.
Oh, got it.
And it means that the sea level rise we've seen has not been as high as it would have normally been if that process wasn't in effect. The interesting thing then is that once you get a shift in climate, the increasing absorption of water by the Earth is only going to go so much, and then suddenly it'll stop.
Right.
So suddenly sea level rise should...
Will shoot up.
Or the rate at which it increases should go up mm-hmm. faster. Anyway, so it was an interesting article.
Neat.
Because it brings to light this whole new part of the hydrological cycle. Mm-hmm. That hasn't been part of the models
right.
yet.
Right, yeah, it seems like I have not really heard that part.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did I write on here where it was? Sea level rise slowed by hydrology. February 12th. Let me just do a quick look up in my literature. Current literature, AAAS. Sea level rise slowed by hydrology. It's a report. Rieger et al. Yep. See if I see a nice picture. So it has some really cool pictures of the Earth that show the different, where the water level is increasing and decreasing
right.
Due to the radar data. And you can see the latitudes across, let me see, southern U.S., Mexico, northern Africa, like Sahara and above,
are very
the
dry.
Middle East, and then this section across the, I don't know, it looks like Western Himalayas or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you have extreme decrease in water content.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's water content in the ground.
Oh, water content in the ground.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then Western Australia and Argentina looks really bad.
Mm-hmm.
But then, Southern Midwest. Canada, Southern Canada, it looks like, or the Northern Midwest only. Yeah. East side of the Rockies, which you think usually rain shadow up in Canada, you know, get humongous amounts of water increase.
Mm-hmm.
Around the largest sections of the Amazon.
Yeah.
East of, around the level of Namibia, it looks like. Well, maybe slightly higher.
Mm-hmm.
But that you justly think of as a desert, right?
Mm-hmm.
Huge increases in water there. Eastern Australia.
Yeah.
And it turns out that these increases, they separate out the increases over time. Oh, they show that, okay, 2002 to 2015 is the data. And they show that they separate out the increases and the decreases. And the increases out are greater than the decreases.
Oh, that's bizarre.
Yeah.
I just would not have expected that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And they do all this modeling about where it's happening and what's happening there. And they're like, and they tease out human of this signal, human driven events versus climate driven events, and it looks like the climate driven events are larger than our human effect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, we're going to feel the human effects because we take the water out of places, and since that's where we're needing water, when those aquifers go dry, we're going to be really hurting because that's where we're taking the water, you know,
mm-hmm.
obviously. But there's other places where it's having the opposite effect just from the climate. Anyway, and NASA satellites, they're called GRACE, Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment. The GRACE satellite mission.
Neat.
Anyway, so yeah, that was a good one. And it goes mm-hmm. really well with this last
It does.
One.
It does. The other thing that you read that I did not get to, but I was interested in, is the ozone hole over Arctic.
Yeah, so do you want me to do that one?
Yeah, if you don't mind.
No, there's it's short. It's mm-hmm. it's a news piece out of Science. It's out of, let me see, February 12th. And basically, they're predicting ozone hole in the Arctic for this spring. So what does that mean? It just means just lower level of ozone. The mechanism and the reason for the prediction goes like this. You need three things to have a significant decrease in ozone. You need the chemicals in the stratosphere mm-hmm. that are going to destroy the ozone. And a lot of them we produced. And then, was it the Montreal? They say something around here. The Montreal Agreement or Protocol kind of got faded out. Because the fading out of, in most of the world, of the use of these chemicals, chlorinated, almost mm-hmm. all of them, used in refrigerants. But, you know, they're still in the air all over the place.
Right.
So you need that. You need it to be cold. And the reason you need it to be cold is that has to do with the chemistry. Somehow more of it gets put into the air up there. I guess over the poles, you have these big gyri that form during their respective winters.
Mm-hmm.
And they...
Are we talking about air currents?
Air currents.
Okay.
In the stratosphere. Mm-hmm. So this is above the weather. And that's where you get the ozone depletion.
Mm-hmm.
And of course you need UV radiation from the sun. And so the reason they have this prediction is because it looks like the chemicals are accumulating, number one. They're seeing these clouds. There's a picture on the report of these clouds. They're formed possibly by the cold, the increased cold causing nitric oxide
Wow.
To condense into droplets, and they form these beautiful clouds that are deadly.
Wow.
Is it nitric oxide or nitrous oxide? I'm looking. Montreal Protocol, 1989. That did the phase out of the chemicals. I just noticed that, looking for what that cloud was. Rare nacreous clouds over Belfast, Ireland. They don't say. Anyway, there's several chemicals that tend to get condensed and form these. Nitric acid. There it is. So the cold temperatures cause nitric acid to condense, and so that forms these iridescent clouds, and then that starts the chain reaction to causing the activation, in quotes, if I remember. I don't remember what the process is, but somehow having the nitric oxide can activate the chlorinated chemicals, and you have active and inactive forms, and the active forms destroy the ozone. They've also measured an increase in the level of the active and a decreased level of the inactive chlorine, I guess, with weather balloons flying through the stratosphere there. And so they're like, well, and the gyrus that's been going on there has been long-lived, and it's happened several times in the past, that it's been extra strong. And they're saying, well, when spring comes, suddenly the Earth tilt is going to be right so that now it gets hit by UV.
Wow.
Probably as soon as that UV hits, you know, from a more straight-in angle, the ozone will start to disappear. One reason this is interesting is, or another reason this is interesting is because it has a connection to climate change. They think that overall, these gyri that form over the poles are going to become less frequent when, as the Earth warms up.
Oh, wow.
But when they do form, it's a little bit like storms.
It's going to be more severe.
They're going to be stronger, and they're going to last a lot longer.
Wow.
So it's a little bit like, instead of a steady ongoing, we're going to have these periods where suddenly in the spring, you've got just tons of ozone being destroyed.
Wow.
And other times, you're not going to have as, you know, almost anything happening. So.
Okay. Well, that was a neat article.
Man, this is turning into a geophysical podcast.
Yes, it is. So, not knowing really what you are going into for this week, because sometimes we talk a lot about our articles, and other times we don't have the chance, and you'll know why we haven't had the chance for a while.
Yep.
But anyway, I started to think about all the things we've done with bioengineering, and that when we looked at the...
Are you moving on to...
I'm moving into the...
plate tectonics.
Plate tectonics.
Cool.
And more of geo.
Yeah.
So what I thought of is, really, I missed a lot of the great papers that we had in the last year based on geology and plate movement and that. So I decided I just need to go back to it and figure it out.
I just have to show you this. So this is what you sent me.
Yeah.
I exported it as a PDF. And these underlines, right, you don't recognize them.
No.
That's me using Zernal. I was reading your write-up of this as if it was an article.
Yeah, well, I cut and pasted parts from the article.
But, you know, you have it all lined up. I mean, I thought it was really funny that I never got to the original article.
Oh, got it, got it. So
but I was reading your notes.
This group, this one article, it was from almost a year ago in March 2015. They're called the Earth Bites Program, and it's a group of scientists from the University of Sydney, and they set up a computer imaging showing the movement of plates. And they tried to think of it in terms of, you know, speed, direction, motion, and different parameters that might impact the movement of plates over time. And we're looking at it in terms of Earth's time. So, you know, when they look at a snapshot, it's over, you know, 20 million years. And so you have this great image that they have that you can go and you can play. And it will show how some plates move relatively slowly compared to others. Mm-hmm. And one of the speedier plates is India, that moves at like 20 centimeters a year. And when you see it in terms of, you know, the whole...
But not normally, right?
Not normally, no. That's, not normally.
I think that's the... When reading from your notes, what I really got out of it is that it's another one, just like with the glacier one we looked at, where suddenly they see stuff happening because they're looking at a finer time scale that was never available before.
Exactly.
And it looks like what you were just saying, 20 or 10 centimeters per year movement of India, is something that on the scales we were looking at before, hundreds of millions of years, you'd never see it.
Right.
Because it just shoots forward for like a million years or 20 million
10
years.
Million years.
10 million years.
Yeah.
At this incredible rate. Mm-hmm. And then it slows back down.
Right.
And
exactly.
We didn't even know this was happening.
Yeah. And so they were trying to, you know, in the model, the continents are like strongly anchored to the plates. However, they expected more of a slab pull with the subduction zones, and that wasn't as big a factor as what they have expected. And so it was just it was a fun and interesting article about what was going on. And then I started to look at other plate movement. Of course, it's just this domino effect. So in October 15th in Science, we have another article where they look at climate cycles and
the
ocean's abyssal hills and the formation of those. And it's really...
This seemed like it was really controversial.
Yes, it is.
And a lot harder to be, to see whether it's correct or not.
Right. So we have Olive and his group of geodynamicists at Columbia University. And they put together a fairly simple model using three different ways that to look at magma. How magma might change the face of the sea floor. And they were trying to figure out what was the mechanism that really caused those huge rifts to occur, rift valleys to occur in the Pacific.
Well, more than finding out, they had a hypothesis.
Right,
that
they
it was
did.
Climate driven.
Right.
Their analysis is really interesting, but you had a lot in your notes about what the people were saying that seemed to contradict them.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed more interesting to me.
Yeah.
Their time scale seemed to be off.
Right. So, you know, a lot more work needs to be done here. But it was interesting to see how, you know, from their study.
What was the original idea?
So, what they thought of is that there's times where you have,
let me see, if it gets warmer, you melt the glaciers, so you have more water, so it puts more pressure, so the magma doesn't come up as much, so you don't get as much, and then it gets colder, form ice sheets, you get less, I mean, the super... simplistic version.
Right.
Magma comes out more and you make hills.
Right.
and the seafloor spreads.
Right.
And then you get a warmer. Yeah. I mean, it's really made sense to me, the counter argument that if you look at the age at which those hills show up, it doesn't match the age of glaciation.
But right. Like,
hundreds of millions of years it takes to form these spreads.
Right.
I love, there's definitely a lot to figure out from their research.
There is. But it's a start.
Yeah.
And it's just the edge of the study.
Yeah.
I think it's just someone looking into an area for the first time.
Yeah.
And this is their first glimpse of it without having, yeah, you know.
Like the guy said that was criticizing it, you know, even if the hypothesis is wrong, it doesn't mean that there's not something really interesting happening,
right,
with the effect of climate on how magma evolves through the surface.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, their hypothesis is too specific to something that doesn't seem to match. And there was a whole, I didn't realize they were saying that most of the magma actually accretes the crust by forming underneath.
Yes. Yeah. So when you look at seafloor spreading,
yeah,
the actual, you know, where you have the spreading of the, you have magma coming up to the surface at an opening. And they said that actually the rock forms deeper down in the crust. Yeah. It's not coming up to the surface.
Filling in between.
Right. It's forming before it comes to the surface even.
So it makes me think that they're sheer,
mm-hmm,
and close to the mid-ocean ridge, it gets thinned.
Yeah.
And then that allows the magma that's closer to it to cool faster and add thickness to it, but then it moves out.
Right.
And the part closest to the center is always thinning, continuously,
right,
being pulled by the...
Yeah.
So
very interesting stuff. I think it'll be fun to get more information about it. But I think that is... Oh, I guess there's only two. I thought there were three. There are two. So that's my little...
Geophysics
tour for this evening.
Well, before we go on to tech stuff, I think we have one more science thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything else?
I do not.
I think we're going on to physics.
Yes, we are.
The big event.
Yes, that was pretty awesome.
It's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you want to tackle what it was, and I tackle the guy who discovered or who first found it, or how do you want to do this?
Okay.
Are we talking about?
Yes.
We are talking about gravitational waves.
Yes. So it's the first time they were able to detect gravitational waves.
Ever.
Ever. And it's something...
It happened just... Well, the announcement.
Yeah.
We're talking about the announcement.
Right.
They detected it on September 14th?
Yes.
Last year?
But it was not announced to more recently.
They just announced it last week.
Right, February 12th.
Well, it's in the February 12th of science.
Science.
But they announced it before that.
Yeah, that's true.
When was the press conference?
I can't remember. But it's not too...
Just a week before.
Yeah, a week before. It was not...
Yeah, it was just this...
Too far off.
Nope.
And... It is part of the LIGO project.
Yep.
And it is, I'm going to have you explain the project, but...
Well, I'm going to talk about the guy.
Okay. So the project was set up. I like the idea. So they have this whole team. They have this whole network of... You know, what I imagine is computers analyzing data coming in. Yeah, 11th
of February press conference.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it was just the day before. I was like,
cool.
I didn't think it was too far before. But anyway, so they have these supercomputers monitoring.
That's just 5 days ago.
Yeah.
It did feel really recent.
Yeah. Yeah. Monitoring and looking for these gravitational waves. And there's a group of, you know, postdocs and graduate students that go on, and their job is to look at the data report coming in and seeing if there's any anomalies. And if they find an anomaly, this group has designed a whole protocol that goes along with, if you find an anomaly, you do this, this, and this.
Exactly.
And what I found was really cool is the injections,
yeah,
putting in, you know, false positives,
right,
and making people go through the process to, yeah, see if they're actually doing what they need to be doing to,
right,
find the actual positive, or if the system is actually functioning and it's showing the positive when the,
yeah,
information is in there. So I thought it was a nice system that they have of checking themselves and checking the technology.
Yeah.
Great,
yeah,
combination. Yeah. Anyway, now on to you.
Do you want to talk about the chart on the article in Science? Because that is an amazing...
This one?
Yeah. Do you want me to...
You can go ahead.
So, I mean... There's several facilities around the world trying to measure gravitational waves. The LIGO system has two sites.
Mm-hmm.
Researchers are all over the world, but
right,
one is in Washington State and the other one is in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And they're independent in a sense, right? Each one of them is an entire site that by itself can detect gravitational waves. And it's they're L-shaped. Their spectrum, we'll just leave it. They're doing, what do they call it when you have bouncing light against a mirror and come back and look for a shift in the phase? Because that's what they're doing, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what it's called. Anyway, it's killing me. What is it called? Look, because we really should know this. It's interferometer,
mm-hmm,
right? Because, okay, so this is a really cool concept. Why is interferometry so precise? If you try to measure how far light goes and comes back, you know, how do you know the distance, right? You have an external measure. But,
mm-hmm,
if you measure the difference between two signals and you match them up so they're in phase, then if you see a change in phase, you don't have to know the precise distance. You know the change in the distance is the wavelength of the light. It's that fraction of the wavelength of light,
mm-hmm,
right? And what's light? If it's visible, it's going to be 400 to 800 nanometers. So something in that range, you can,
mm-hmm,
tell, right? But they can go way more precise than this.
Right.
The chart shows these L shapes. So the idea is you bounce light off mirrors,
mm-hmm,
2 4-kilometer long legs. And if a wave of gravity is passing through the area, it's going to be going along one of the legs more than the other. And you match it up so the two legs, just,
mm-hmm,
by slight tweaking, have exactly the same phase light when they bounce off of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just wait,
mm-hmm,
see what happens. And if one of the legs gets stretched relative to the other, then suddenly that signal will be out of phase relative to the other one.
Right. Yeah.
So that's where the accuracy comes. Now, the chart they have in the news item is just amazingly cool because it has the wave, gravitational wave, going by at the one of the sites in red and the other site in blue, the Washington,
mm-hmm,
and Louisiana sites. And, you know, you can imagine a truck driving by is going to give you vibration. An earthquake,
mm-hmm,
anywhere in the world, if this is so precise, is going to cause your vibrations to go through and mess up.
Right.
The two charts, when you put them on top of each other, they match very closely to each mm-hmm. other, but they've been shifted. They've right. been shifted. One of them has been shifted in time by the time it takes for light to travel from Washington State to Louisiana, and right. they fall right on top of each other.
Isn't that cool?
That is just amazing.
Mm-hmm. So, that is really cool.
Anyway, I just thought that chart was just, I yep. had to
no, that go is into cool. it a little more. It's 0.007 seconds delay.
Yeah.
Which is just, you know, seven to think of that, you
That's
know.
That's pretty long when you think about it. 7 milliseconds.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah. Certainly cheap cameras now take frames a fair bit faster than that.
Mm-hmm. But anyway.
So there's another article. This I don't think this was published in any of the science journals, but it's on their website.
Right.
It's by Adrian Cho, who did the other article also. Mm-hmm. On, and but it showed up on the AAAS Science website. And the title was, "Here's the First Person to Spot Those Gravitational Waves." It shows a picture of a guy at a computer looking at a screen. His name is Marco Drago. So he's part of this team of, I think mm-hmm. there's several thousand people involved in the project.
Right.
And like you said, it's like, you know, you've got postdocs and their job is to go about doing some of their work. But they're also on duty for a time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, he's from Italy, but he was in, at his job, which is mm-hmm. at one of the Max Planck Institutes in Germany. So that's where he's right. working right now. And he was doing something or other, and he got an email mm-hmm. Message, which was...
From the system.
Automatically sent out from mm-hmm. the system because he was on duty, saying that in its continuous analysis of the stuff coming out, that something needed to be checked. And what I think is really cool there is, you know, science doesn't have to be an adventure. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, it's just something you do. Mm-hmm. You do experiments and stuff. But there's some moments that are like Indiana Jones, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's felt like that at the time or if Adrian Cho's writing made it feel like the ultimate adventure. But it was like sending chills up my spine when I was reading this. It's just such a good read. So he's sitting there, right? He's doing work. He gets the email. And I will bring up the history as it goes because it's so cool.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to check. And the data coming out shows that there's this big signal. Mm-hmm. And the amplitude is something like 24 times what you'd normally need to see above the noise instead of what you'd expect from usually when he gets an email,
mm-hmm.
which he gets emails, I don't know if it was several times a week or several times a month, but, you know, it's not like unheard mm-hmm. of. And usually it's 10 times. So normally what would happen is, well, you start to analyze the data, which means basically looking at all the possibilities of things that it could be,
bringing right.
on the data and stuff, and trying to see, is this really a gravitational wave? And every time it's happened, it happens several times a week, you always find why it happened, and it's not a gravitational wave. Maybe you don't find out why it happens, but the signals from the two sites don't match.
Okay. Right.
So, whatever. If, and this has happened once before, if it really looks like a gravitational wave, then you do the analysis in more and more depth, try to discount all the other possibilities and mm-hmm. come up with something. You write up the paper, this is like several months later, and you're about to publish it, and then there's only four people, some of the leaders, there's four of the leaders of the project that have been chosen that know when the special system has mm-hmm. been activated.
Right.
To put in, I think they call it a secret injection.
Or a blind injection.
Blind injection.
Injections. Mm-hmm.
And only when you're about to publish will they tell you, no, sorry, this was fake. And it's happened once before. Okay. But he sees that, and normally it'd be like, well, you just go on, do the process. But the signal to noise ratio was 24.
Mm-hmm.
So that means two things. One, when you start doing the checks to see that it's something else, unless you find it pretty fast, the signal to noise is so strong, it's not going to be something else. It's going to be a gravitational mm-hmm. wave, number one. Number two, well, I mean, if it's so strong, it's probably a blind injection, mm-hmm. but you have to go through.
You have to go through the process.
Except that the system's been down for 5 years for an upgrade. Mm-hmm. And just that week, they were about to put it back online, mm-hmm. and they ran out of time to get some stuff done. I can't remember what happened. And they decided to delay it a week.
Mm-hmm.
And during this time, you have other kinds of injections. I think they're called open injections.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, where you put it into data and everybody knows it, so it's not blind.
Right.
And the purpose of this is to calibrate your instruments. So some part of the system in all this collection says, okay, we're going to put in a signal right now. Everybody see what you're getting and calibrate it. So that's what you measure at your spot or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, LIGO wasn't even running.
Right.
Because, well, it was running, but it wasn't running in its data collection mode. It was running in what's called an engineering run. And the engineering run was going to go for an extra week because everything wasn't ready.
Mm-hmm.
So people are putting in
weird stuff.
Open injections or whatever mm-hmm. they call them, right? And they're doing different things and stuff. So that's always a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
But the blind injection system wasn't ready yet, along mm-hmm. with a few other things. So the signal-to-noise ratio is 24, and he knows it can't be a blind injection because the system's not even existent. So he checks the log,
mm-hmm.
and there's nothing logged mm-hmm. for an open injection. So what the hell? So he gets together with a buddy, and they're trying to figure it out. It's like, no, it doesn't look like it's could be anything else. So they call up the two sites, and at one of them it's 2 a.m, at the other it's 5 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
They only reach one of the sites, and they're like, no one's here doing anything, it's just running smoothly. So he's like, okay. They spend, I think, like another week desperately trying to find what caused this, because this can't be right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And finally, out of desperation, he sends an email to the entire 2,000-some collaboration saying, does anybody know what could possibly have caused this kind of an injection of a signal in there? And he gets no responses. And everybody else that gets this email, everybody mm-hmm. reads it, knows exactly what it means.
I know. They must have been like, ah!
Yeah. So everybody in the whole collaboration knows we've detected gravitational waves. I mean, this has got to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they finish up the engineering run, and they go into data collection mode in order to collect data to see if there's gravitational waves.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what they're doing, really.
Right.
I mean, that's what they're doing. But the real purpose now is they already have a detection. What they need to know is, with the new system, after this upgrade that took 5 years and $250 million, is this the type of signal that's going to keep showing up because of something we didn't expect or whatever? And they go on for months. And after months of collection, they don't have anything other than gravitational waves that can explain it. And that's when they give the announcement. And so the paper's being sent in. And yeah, it looks like this is a strong
signal. What a wonderful discovery.
Yeah. So a few more things before we go on, because this is so huge.
Mm-hmm.
It was very difficult for them to keep the wraps on all this. There was rumors circulating, mostly through mm-hmm. social media and stuff, leaking out,
right.
not on purpose, just by
no.
mistake. But since then, all this time they've been collecting data, that's been under wraps too. No one said its gravitational waves because we have not seen anything like that since. What they've said is, we've collected enough data that we know this is a gravitational wave. Yeah. They might already have others.
Yeah.
Right? This was a huge upgrade. They might not, but I think the broader point here is that not just that we've just, for the first time, I mean, gravitational light waves, in a sense, indirectly, have been seen. There was that group they mentioned that saw pulsars spiraling mm-hmm. into each other, and the rate at which they were spiraling in could only be explained by gravitational waves. But that's not measuring them.
Right.
You know, these are ones that hit the Earth on September 14th and just went right by. Mm-hmm. And we were there with the equipment to see it. So the point is, it's not just that we've just discovered them, it's that now we're going to be able to do this if they're at a certain signal-to-noise ratio when they hit us. And as it happens, we're going to be able to have theory and experiments now, or observation at least, you know, be able to bounce off of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Nowhere ever have we been able to have observational data having to do with a strong effect of gravity. Gravity has always been so weak. So this is like a whole new type of astronomy. And there's another site in Italy that is going to try to measure gravitational waves. They have 3 kilometer arms, I think. I think there's a site in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So these sites are going to start to show up all over the world. It's new kind of astronomy. It's just
nice.
Amazingly cool.
It is cool. And, you know, Patrick's excitement about this new discovery, and that, even though it is a fantastic discovery, also is probably part of him having a wonderful week.
I had a wonderful week.
Okay. And so I thought we should start to wrap up our wonderful success.
What? Never mentioned why. I don't know how they know, but the gravitational waves, they say, came from 2 black holes spiraling into each other and merging 1.3 billion years ago.
Wow.
So that many light billion years away from us, because it travels the speed of light. Anyway, it's kind of cool.
Can't wait to see the article.
So, okay. So you want to talk about stuff?
I guess you do have a few tech things. So how about
a
few tech things.
This will go super fast.
Okay.
From Linux Voice issue 24, I think it is. There's an opinion piece put out by Ian Murdoch with every issue, and he has a nice write-up about the write-up is by Simon Phipps,
right.
His opinion piece, but he has a write-up about Ian Murdoch that died
recently.
Was it like a month ago or mm-hmm. so? Anyway, and he was the founder of the Debian project, which we use on a whole bunch of our computers here. And so that's really sad and too bad.
Mm-hmm. It is. He's such a young man. And to think of all the things,
it's really
that
cool.
That he's done. And
it's really just cool he put on. You know, you think that projects that are put together by groups of people tend to not be as good as people that have like a vision.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, but people that have a vision tend to want to hold on to things and then go off into weird directions. And his seems to be like the perfect in between, where he gave up the project, allowed other people to take control of it, and set up a system that works.
Mm-hmm.
And has created, I mean, to me, it's the greatest operating system out there.
Mm-hmm.
The Debian operating system. Well, no, see, it's the Debian desktop. So it's the best. I misspoke. It's the best desktop up there.
Okay.
And
I just wanted to make sure I mentioned the name.
You know, it powers so much of Linux, mm-hmm. because so much of the development is done to make people's projects come up as to packages that can then be used easily by other people, mm-hmm. like us.
Right, right,
that are not
exactly. going to
compile it. And it's done there. And, well, big cheer to all the developers that mm-hmm. work
in open source. And that's anyway. Awesome.
So, and then the other thing was from the same issue. There's a fun article comparing all the different free software licenses. Freedom as in free to do what you want with it. And the three ones that I found were that seemed to be the biggest for comparing is the GPL, which basically says, if you take this code that we have out and it's mm-hmm. GPL license, you can use it any way you want. You can change it any way you want. But if you provide it commercially to anyone else as some kind of a program, you have to give them the source code if they ask, and you have to show all the changes that you made, and you have to give them all your new source code. So that's really asking a lot, but it's like it's made the environment we have now.
Mm-hmm.
Because so much of what was worked on back then, now we can use. The exact opposite way of treating free software is let me look for it over here, BSD style licenses. With those ones, it basically says you can take the code, do whatever you want with it. You have to give credit to the people that first came up with the code.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not allowed to use... Now, although you have to give credit to them, you're not allowed to use them to endorse your new piece of software where
right.
you created the code. So I thought, okay, so that's kind of interesting. But you don't have to release any code or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of private companies have used BSD license code and then created programs out of them, not released it. And I thought there was a really interesting, I never understood before this or didn't look at carefully, the lesser GPL. And it's really neat. It's like an in-between. It says, okay, so you have free code, and you can compile it as a library, and then you can link to it so your program includes that. And then when you release your program, you have to give the original code that you used that was in the library, but you don't have to actually use yours. I mean, you don't have to, release your code. So it's a way for people to use free code but still make proprietary programs.
Oh, got it.
So,
that's interesting.
Anyway, it's a good write-up.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot more to it than that, but I thought those were the big three
yeah,
points.
Yeah, I have to look at it. I'm just curious.
Okay, that is all I have for sciencey stuff.
Okay, now it comes to you. All about you.
I'm not even
and
look at
your project.
How much time we've spent already.
Yeah, that's why I started to wrap up. I have.
Skip Falls Lake and OCAD orienteering, because we haven't been doing much of that. That's going to
wrap up. Right, you're going to talk about what you...
I'm going to talk about...
Okay.
I'm just thinking we can skip all this type of stuff.
Yeah, that's fine.
The big success was from my blog, or mm-hmm. I put it on my blog, and it's last week, after 2 weeks of hard work from mm-hmm. the time I got the boards from OSH Park to just last weekend,
mm-hmm.
going through a mad building. I spent really every minute
mm-hmm.
putting the stuff together.
Yes.
Took about 1 week. to put the three transmitters, well, to solder them all together. Mm-hmm. And it took about another week to put the enclosures all together. And oh, I screwed up our website. What's this? If you go down, there's some funky, what the hell is that? Oh, I put in some French, à la bataille. And it came up, it's supposed to be UTF-8.
Okay.
Okay, I think I can fix that. Anyway, but so what are the salient points about the building process? Before the boards arrived, I had absolutely everything set up, and I talked about that in the blog entry before.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything was in bags and ready to go, and all the documentation was ready. Oh, you have that up here.
Mm-hmm.
How are you seeing that?
Because you haven't updated our blog to the website. I'm just looking at what's...
Oh, you're looking at what's on the server on the internet,
and
I'm looking on our home server.
Right.
Yeah, because I'm waiting for
mine, which is coming.
Yeah. I saw you have the title and everything. Mm-hmm. It's going to be about enrichment.
Oh, so that's the one before.
Let me finish this, I guess. Yeah. So, and then when I started to build it, I build it one of these virtual modules at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And every time it was done, I tested it. And every time when I was building it, I built all three boards, three modules, mm-hmm. like that. When something didn't work, if it didn't work with one of the modules, it's a soldering mistake.
Right.
If it didn't work with all three, then it was... mistaken design. And there were some problems both ways, in design and in soldering, and they were caught really fast.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot longer before you get your first board, but when the boards get this complicated,
right.
it is really worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nice.
And I show on the thing, not all of the tests, but just one of them where I measured the output of the SI-5351.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge step, because after that, all of the really tough components to solder are already on the board, and all the really tricky parts are done,
mm-hmm.
including the code. And then just this, was it Sunday or Saturday?
Yeah.
Sunday.
Valentine's Day.
That's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We went over to the school and we set a few up to test out how it would work for the enrichment club
mm-hmm.
meeting, and I think we decided that it's not going to work the way we wanted. The kids won't be able to tell the directions very well
mm-hmm.
If we put them too close together.
Right.
But we
found a nice workaround. I think it will.
We still have to test that too.
We do.
Because
we do.
Yeah.
I'm very hopeful that it'll work.
Yeah, I think so.
So we will talk more about that.
Anyway, that is all I have for
Great.
The transmitters.
Okay. So, I didn't. Okay. So we should probably wrap up now.
Are
We've
you
had
talk about yours?
I was
not going to.
I might mention it the next one.
Okay.
But we have a really nice podcast that mm-hmm. went for a while, and I think this is a good
Actually,
time.
Actually, that's not too bad.
To wrap
hour
up.
And 20, that's our usual, an hour and 20 minutes or so.
Yeah. That's why I was just trying to keep it, you know, just over the hour. Mm-hmm. So we've had a wonderful, crazy time. Where Pat's been building like mad.
Yep.
And so we haven't been talking about our articles. So as we come together, we're like, wow, that's a nice article. but thank
Are
you.
We
yeah.
Done?
We're going to do our wrap up.
Okay. Thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog, and I'll have mine done soon.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.